Formosa Files is sponsored by the Frank C. Chen Cultural Foundation. Frank Chen, Chen Qichuan, served as the mayor of Kaohsiung City from 1960 to 1968 and founded the Kaohsiung Medical College.
Formosa Files.
Welcome to Formosa Files. I'm John Ross, and once again, I'm joined by Chris Stowers, a writer and photographer based in Taipei.
Hi, John. It's good to be back again.
Absolutely. We're going to continue our tale of an amazing voyage in a traditional Chinese junk. If you recall from the first episode, five fishermen from China, but stranded in Taiwan after the Civil War, they want to join an international yacht race from the east coast of the US to Sweden. And they're going to enter a junk in this yacht race.
It's adventurous of them. Yeah, after much difficulty, they had found and bought a junk in Geelong, where they were living and working for the government fisheries. And they named this junk Free China in exchange for sponsorship from the governor of Taiwan.
The junk was from Fujian province in China, originally designed to carry lumber. The total length of the junk was 24 meters, a beam, that's a width of 5.4 meters, draft 1.5 meters, and it has two masts.
Right, and so draft means how deep it is, not that it's draft beer or anything like that. Yeah. And she's of an unknown age.
Correct. The original papers were lost. The current owner who sold it to Paul Zhou, who's the mastermind behind this junk entering the race, he's bought it in an auction.
An auction. So were the authorities involved because it had been seized?
Yes. Caught smuggling opium and confiscated by the Taiwanese customs.
So it's February 1955. And at that time, the junk is signed over to Paul Zhou. He becomes the official owner of the junk.
How much time do they have?
121 days, counting down to the start of the race. They figured they needed 70 days to get from Geelong to the east coast of America for the race where it begins, which means 51 days left to get the junk in shape and to handle all the paperwork.
Our crew consists of six young men, all mainlanders working for the fisheries, but on motorized boats. They don't have sailing experience.
But fortunately, they're all single, except for one guy.
Yes, that's the discrepancy before I said five guys and then just six. This married guy, he's got kids, and his wife was understandably a little concerned that she would never see him again, and he pulled out.
But they soon have a replacement. When they were applying for visas, the American vice consul, Calvin Mellert, became greatly interested in the voyage.
Calvin. Yeah, an interesting guy. He's first been to China as an 18-year-old Marine and later studied Chinese language and international relations. He has a master's degree from Johns Hopkins University.
Anyway, he visited the junk one day during the visa process, and he said something, which I'll paraphrase here, and apologies for not even thinking of attempting to do it in an American accent. He said, "I noticed the other day when you guys, came to the U.S. Embassy asking for visas that there were six names, but with one crossed out. And just now, I see there are six sleeping spaces on the junk. I wonder if you guys would like another crew member. Could I join?"
And by join, he clarifies he'd just be going across the Pacific with them, not joining the transatlantic yacht race itself. The five men had to talk about whether to let him join. Well, argue about it. Putting aside the fact the guy is an American, why have an outsider? These men were all fishing colleagues. They had known each other for years.
Well, they discussed it, and finally, they agreed to let Calvin join them. But what do you think was the winning point? Why did they finally accept him to become a member?
Well, they thought he might be helpful in the U.S. Originally, they'd planned after reaching North America to sail down the coast through the Panama Canal and then up the East Coast to the race start.
But the Panama Canal, would that allow such a vessel to go through it?
It would have to be towed. But anyway, that was the original plan. Now they figure it needs to be transported overland across the US. That'll be quicker.
Wow. That's quite a challenge.
Yeah. So Calvin becomes the sixth crew member. The other men are Paul Joe, there's Reno, Benny, Marco, and Hulu.
The six men have a lot of work to do. The junk was old and in poor shape, and repairs were needed, expensive ones too. So just as well that they had help from the government, the Taiwan government. They hired a junkwright, or a shipbuilder, from Fuzhou to do the repairs.
An old guy, and in similar condition to the junk. He's missing an eye and several teeth. But there wasn't much choice. The mechanical age of ships was well underway, and junks and the related skills were hard to find.
The junk sails, they were a sight for sore eyes, actually. They were in very poor condition and had been patched up with flour sacks and rags.
So they needed a new set of sails, two of them, foresail and mainsail, and the old ones were kept as spares.
They also needed a new set of battens. These are the long wooden slats running horizontally that help keep sails, particularly of junks, help them keep their shape.
Easy enough, just long pieces of bamboo. Such a magnificent material, bamboo.
Indeed, lots of uses for bamboo. But the weight of those bamboo slats combined with the sail materials, that all adds up. And from my experience on the boogie boat sailing across the Java Sea, the weight of the sails, even without bamboo battens, was something that surprised us. In fact, my own experience was something akin to that of Calvin, in that not being French or being a speaker of French like Freddie, our sole Swiss crew member, I was in a minority of one. But the mainsail was so heavy it required six men to raise it, and they needed a seventh man, one to steer whilst all the sail hauling was taking place. So I was in luck. I imagine the Free China crew were similarly surprised at the physical manpower demanded just to set sail in a junk.
Right, which is what the crew find out when they start their training. They paid the skipper of the junk to stay on and show them how to handle it.
Yeah, he tells them that the junk is badly undermanned. Just six men, he says. You need 12 to raise the sail and a guy on the tiller. It's a long wooden handle connected to the rudder. In the case of my boat, which is a boogie prahu, it's like a spice ship, the tiller was carved from a single block of solid teak wood. And the rudder, of course, is a movable board positioned at the stern of the ship underwater, which is what actually forces the ship left or right, or to use the correct nautical terminology, to port and starboard. When you're on a ship, you have to adopt all these ancient terms. The ship's wheel was a relatively new invention, actually, becoming popular on larger sailing vessels only at the start of the 18th century. So Christopher Columbus navigated to the New World on his ship La Nina for shore using just a tiller. The tiller is located at the stern, the back of the ship, and moving the tiller by extension moves the rudder. Now, unmotorized, like boats with no engine, like my Bugis Prahu, the God bless, still used this simple design of tiller, as did Chinese junks well into the 20th century, the Free China being no exception.
When Paul Joe is told that a dozen people are needed to handle the sails, he's skeptical. Yeah, they rigged up a triple block tackle and attached it to the top of the mast.
That sounds very technical, triple block tackle. Basically, it's three pulleys working in conjunction with each other, little mechanical wheels that help to multiply force.
Right, so this helped our rookie sailors, but it was still too hard to raise the sail.
They could get a hand-cranked winch. That would help.
Yes, they did, but it was too slow, so they got a small motor to power the winch.
Right, this junk was designed for coastal sailing, right? Short trips. So they'd need to increase the water tank storage for going across the ocean because you can't pull in and get new water. We had problems with our own water supplies, some of the containers splitting and leaking during a storm, and the water that we'd brought up from the well on Jean-Pierre Island contained in a huge barrel lashed to the mast was becoming rather brackish. That's like salty and off-putting to drink after 2 weeks at sea. But Joe and his crew are contemplating a much longer voyage than mine.
Yes, they had four new wooden water tanks built in two of the cargo holds.
Speaking of cargo, this junk doesn't have any, which is a problem. The ship will sit too high in the water and, you know, it'll be unstable, rocking backwards and forwards on the wave. Our boat, the God Bless, was designed to sit low and let the waves just rush over her deck. She was designed to carry a minimum, I think, of 20 tons of cargo. But after we had toiled away, loading her up with 2 tons of sandbags, going backwards and forwards back on her home island, we were too exhausted to put any more in the ballast. The ship looked beautiful, like a pirate ship riding high, but we had badly underestimated how many tons we needed, and we paid for that in the storms to come.
Good point about ballast. For the Free China, they added 5 tons of cobblestones spread among the cargo holds. But that's still quite light compared to its normal load, I think 20 tons of cargo. And the cobblestones weren't properly placed either. More on that later. For navigation, they've been given, borrowed or bought a few things, a star finder, navigation tables, a compass, a nautical almanac, a sextant.
Which are all great if you know how to use them and navigate with them. GPS is so much simpler, but Joe's voyage was in 1955 and even mine in 1988. Well, GPS, though in its infancy, didn't really become publicly available until the early 1990s. So like Paul and his crewmates, we had a map, my old backpacking map of Southeast Asia, and a 1924 chart. I think the Dutch had drawn this chart of the waters around Singapore, which had changed a bit in the intervening 64 years. A sextant, but Pascal, our captain, didn't really know how to compute the readings. I think he brought the wrong almanacs along with him for the Northern Hemisphere, not the Southern Hemisphere. And we had a compass, of course, just like Paul. By far the best navigational aids we had, though, were the stars. But of course, they're only useful at night and then dead reckoning. So guessing where we were, basically. Most of the time, we were just blown along on the trade winds and hope not to bump into any uncharted islands. At least it sounds like Paul's crew were more experienced than us in this respect, having been fishermen already for a number of years.
Back in Geelong, there's one last hitch. The Taiwanese authorities said that to get a sailing permit, they must have a ship-to-shore communication radio on board.
Well, luckily, they were given a marine radio transmitter. But, of course, because this story is full of these buts, it only operated in Morse code and not voice. So someone on the Free China had to pass the radio operator's test using Morse code to get a license and then permission to sail.
So Paul Joe had to learn Morse code.
It's not that hard, I suppose. 26 codes, one for each letter of the alphabet, 10 for numbers and a few for punctuation. Yeah. But the hassle is reaching the speed required to pass the test. So lots of practice.
Yeah. I should rewind a little. Some of the preparation was done while the Free China was in dry dock, and then some done after it's back in the water.
And that launch, talking about it, getting the junk actually into the water, out of dry dock and down the slipway, that was a big event.
Yes, on March 8, 1955. So that's 6 months after Paul read about the yacht race in the newspaper. Yeah, there was a big launching celebration with lots of firecrackers, of course.
And the Free China, she looked great. The body was painted yellow, the cabin in white, and her ragged old sails were now clean white canvas. Its new name, Free China, was in black, painted in both English and Chinese.
And the boat was christened, got its new name, christened by the mayor's wife with a bottle of French champagne, which the American Vice Consul Calvin had brought. And this champagne, the bottle's tethered to the bow, just needs to be released. It would swing by its own weight and crash on the bow.
But this strange Western custom is new to the mayor's wife. When she released the bottle, it fell short of the bow. That's the front of the ship. And the bottle is supposed to smash on the bow and bring good luck, you see. But the mayor's wife, she wanted to help, so she just picked up the bottle and threw it at the junk, and the bottle fell and broke.
Here's an excerpt from Paul Joe's book, The Junk That Challenged the Yachts. Quote, "Watching the foam rising on the slipway, Marco turned to Calvin and said, 'See what I told you? What a waste! You should have let me drink it. I have never tasted champagne before.'" End quote. I have to agree with that. I've never liked that wasteful custom.
Yeah, it's like at the end of Formula One, isn't it? Spraying all that champers around.
Criminal.
Anyway, the boat is sort of christened and is in the water. Now, here's a nice touch. The bill for those dockyard repairs was picked up by the authorities, by General Chen Liang, former general and now head of the fisheries organization.
The Free China Junk Project had really caught people's imagination, and there was a lot of help from the government, from individuals, private groups.
Yeah, even the Rotary Club got involved. They were especially generous, providing food supplies, enough for about 5 months. You know, six people for 5 months, a lot of food. There was 500 pounds of rice, 20 pounds of peanuts, 20 pounds of soya beans, bags of flour. There were dozens and dozens of cans of meat, 18 dozen bottles of soy sauce, 28 pounds of tea.
Just a few bottles of alcohol, I'm afraid to say. No daily rum rations for our sailors.
I don't know how you can run a navy without rum. Here's a cruel touch for you, John. There were 300 glass bottles, and these were delivered by the Marine Product Research Institute. And in each bottle, there was not alcohol, but a note asking to the finder to send it back to the institute. Do we know how many bottles were actually recovered?
I don't know, but at least 10 in the first year or so.
Wow.
Happy to hear from any listeners who do know.
Quite a good recovery rate. So as you said, people were actually very interested in this junk voyage, and people would come and visit it in Geelong Port. Some of these visitors were actually high-placed foreigners.
Curious and generous visitors. An American naval captain gave them a lifeboat compass and a box of distress rockets and a pistol launcher to go with them.
Very handy if you didn't have them in the first place.
Yeah. One of these Western visitors was the head of Western Enterprises. Western Enterprises, he gave them an inflatable rubber life raft.
That sounds quite innocuous and innocent, doesn't it? Western Enterprises Incorporated. But in fact, they were a front company for the CIA, isn't that right? They did a lot of covert operations in China and Southeast Asia at the time.
Yes, a badly kept secret, it must be said. In his book, Paul Joe says, quote, "Everyone on the waterfront knew that it was the cover for the American secret operation sponsored by its Central Intelligence Agency," end quote. Among the generous helping hands was the American military commissary. They had some expired or soon to expire film for a movie camera, several thousand feet of not amateur 8mm, but beautiful 16mm Kodachrome film.
Wow.
"Do you want it?" they asked Calvin, this American vice consul who's invited himself along.
It'd be stupid to turn that offer down. Kodachrome, it's a really nice color film. And that's at a time, 1955, when black and white was much more common and cheaper, a lot cheaper than color film. So it's too good an offer to refuse. He went out, or Calvin went out, and he bought a used film camera right there and then. And as a result, there's some lovely footage that survived of this remarkable voyage.
My Formosa Files co-host, Eric, will put links up on our website.
So March the 23rd, 1955, and they took the Free China out to the open sea for a test cruise. It was the first time any of the men had ever sailed on a sailboat.
Some newspaper reporters were out with them, but they soon became seasick. Yeah, they soon went into the cabin to rest and keep out of the men's way. And through the cabin door, they could see a lot of action, but not the guy at the tiller behind them. This was the old skipper who the men had hired to train them. And Paul Joe gives a description from the resulting newspaper coverage. The quote is, "The five young ocean-bound sailors handled the Free China expertly like the old salts in a Hollywood pirate movie." Okay, this is what was in the newspaper.
Yes, but in reality, reflecting on the test run when they got back to Geelong, the crew members realized none of them had actually put a hand on the tiller the whole time. The old sea salt had been controlling the boat for the test run.
Okay, so April 4th, 1955, 68 days before the start of the race, the Free China is ready to leave Geelong. There's a big send-off, politicians and regular citizens, a huge crowd, speeches and fireworks.
Yeah, they cast off their mooring lines and the tow out of the port begins. They need the tow, of course, because the boat doesn't have an engine. Firecrackers are exploding, confetti fills the air, boat horns blast.
Paul was in tears.
It's always an emotional moment to leave the safety of a home port.
No doubt, but in his book, he says it was because of the smoke from the firecrackers.
I was happy to be getting away.
Yeah. Now they're well out from the Geelong breakwater. Time for the tug ride to end and for Captain Marco to shout, "Raise sails!"
So they raised the sails.
Oh, were that it so easy, quoting from Paul's book. The next hour was spent in shouting and pulling while we tried to get the junk on a comfortable tack. Suddenly, both our sails puffed up. Then the junk came alive. She listed her body gracefully as a racing bike rounding a sharp bend. But come morning, what's this? They're back near Geelong. They were so close they could see buildings and actually tell which buildings were which.
Yes, they've indeed got problems with navigation and also with their sails. What happened was the lubricant they're using on their pulleys is clogging up the ropes. They should probably head back to port to sort things out, but that would be so humiliating.
Not just humiliating, but it could mean the end of the trip. They might not get permission for another voyage.
Right, a tough decision for the captain to make. But speaking of the captain, although the Free China is Paul's ship and it's his idea, surprisingly, he's not the captain, is he? Nor is Hulu, the eldest of the six men.
Correct. In his book, Paul writes, quote, "Both Hulu and I were very opinionated and abrasive in our manner of speech." End quote. The six men decided on Marco. Apparently, he was an easygoing, friendly fellow.
Really goes against the grain of a captain in the true Navy fashion. But the captain would have limited power anyway. This Free China was going to be freer than the Republic of China was named after. Important matters would be put to the vote.
How did things work on your boogie boat sailing the Java Sea?
Well, imagine a combination of Lord of the Flies meets the Mutiny on the Bounty. You get some idea. We had more of an opinionated captain, contrary to the democratic way that they elected a conciliatory person, Marco, to be the captain of the Free China. Our captain was Pascal. Now, he was a born leader and the eldest of us. And he just assumed control from the start. None of us actually questioned his authority since he was the only one of us who'd ever sailed before. That's one big reason why. Though there were a lot of grumblings amongst us in the lower ranks when he was safely out of earshot. Most of the time, we were just too tired and dehydrated and hungry and a little bit scared to raise much of a fuss, though.
Like too tired to mutiny, yeah.
Yeah, it's like being on a prison chain gang, actually.
Yes. Okay, anyway, on the Free China, our six men are sitting off the Taiwan coast. They have a decision to make, and they take a vote. Should they go back into the port or keep going? Mm-hmm. Anyway, there was one abstention, one vote for going on. That was Reno, I think, and four votes for returning to Geelong.
So they had to go back. And the voyage took just 6 hours compared to the 2.5 days outward. They dropped anchor inside the breakwater of Geelong Harbour, and they want to make this return 3 days after the massive high-profile send-off painless.
They tell the captain of the vessel that comes out that they don't want to clear customs and officially re-enter. No doing is the reply, and there are orders to bring them in.
Oh, they've been spotted. The authorities told them to abort their trip. Their sailing permit is revoked. Their dream and all the work was ultimately for nothing.
And now they have the nightmare of reporters besieging them, doing stories on their failure.
That's the worst fate. It's worth one last shot, though. They needed some help from someone up high.
Yes, their boss, the chairman of the board at the Fishing Administration. He's ex-military, General Chen, and he's an important figure. He was the mayor of Shanghai for a month, at least. That was in the final weeks of Shanghai. This general knew a lot of the right people. He was an old schoolmate of President Chiang Kai-shek.
The generalissimo himself, Chiang Kai-shek. That's a pretty good connection.
Not bad. So our sailors asked for his help, and Paul writes, quote, "Like everyone else, the general tried to persuade us to give up our trip."
But he was a good soul. He helped them. even personally vouching for the men when someone in the government raised the possibility that these men might not be reliable.
Right. When Taiwanese went overseas, family members should remain in Taiwan, but these guys had family members over in China. So what if they defected to the communists?
What with their super secret junk that they could have given to the Chinese? Defection might sound like an impossibility, but more probable than them getting to the transatlantic race start. These guys are in the junk and, you know, it doesn't even seem to be seaworthy and they can't sail it very well. So I guess those were founded concerns.
But the general worked his magic, and on April 15th, 1955, they get a sailing permit. They slipped out of the harbor, no fireworks, no crowds. And because they couldn't handle the junk properly, they needed to be towed out.
So after a few days, I think they had some more problems. But rather than head back again, they stopped at the Diaoyutai or the Senkaku Islands for a few days. That's closer to Japan, right? To sort out equipment and other problems. The cobblestones used as ballast were rubbing against wood, creating grit, and this was clogging up their bilge water pump. Who could have foreseen that?
And then they continued. We should give their route. They're not heading directly across the Pacific Ocean.
No, they're following the ocean currents and winds. So they thought about this pretty well, actually. And they're taking a more northerly route. They're headed to Yokohama, the port city for Tokyo, from where they'll head across the Pacific.
But before that, they run into trouble. A typhoon is bearing down on them, and they've got more problems. They need to put out a Morse code distress message. The words of the message are, tiller broken, lost steerage, need help, ask U.S. Navy in Okinawa. Well, that's all we have time for, so we'll have to continue this, wrap it up next episode. Chris, thanks very much for your help.
I was just getting into that. All right, John, I look forward to being with you next time.